Long gone are the days of waiting for mail or newspapers. In the world of technology, information can travel the world in mere seconds. In minutes, information can go viral. Hello, my name is Mitya Linz from Rights Direct, the international subsidiary of Copyright Clearance Center. Welcome to our latest edition of Copyright on the Continent, the podcast series from Rights Direct. Digital information spreads quickly today via email, downloads, or search engines. But what are the implications for copyright law if the content can be instantly accessed and shared around the globe? What are the challenges in international copyright practices? What are countries doing to harmonize their copyright laws in order to address these challenges? Joining me today is Jens Bammel. He's the Secretary General of the International Publishers Association. He offers a lot of experience and insight into international practice and happenings related to copyright. Today we will discuss recent trends and what these trends could mean for the future of copyright law, both at a national and international level. Thank you for joining us today, Jens.
Well, hello, and thank you very much for having me.
We're glad to have you today. You're the Secretary General at IPA and have years of experience in publishing. So, Jens, what does IPA do?
The International Publishers Association is an international federation of national publishers associations. You can think of it of what FIFA is to football, IPA is to publishing. Our mission really is to ensure that publishers and ultimately authors around the world can invest their passion, their livelihood, their talents, their careers, and their financial resources into an industry, into the publishing industry, so that it can continue to provide its value for society. Ultimately, that means that we have to deal at an international level mainly with three different issues. First of all, we deal with intellectual property, and there mainly with copyright issues. Secondly, we promote freedom of expression and freedom to publish and fight against censorship and support our colleagues who are in the courts and being prosecuted for what they write or publish. And thirdly, we look at industry policy issues and try to promote and protect all the and develop the infrastructure that is necessary to have a healthy global publishing industry.
IPA comprises of national and specialized publisher associations from over 50 countries. What types of publishers are you representing through your membership?
Well, very roughly, there are three different kinds of publishing industries that we represent, each with its own specific criteria and different business models and different issues and concerns. First of all, there is the consumer market, what is known as trade publishing. That's probably about a third of the publishing industry worldwide. Secondly, there is the scientific, technical, and medical publishing area, which is the largest part of the scholarly and professional communication. That's all the academic journals and the like. And thirdly, and probably the biggest publishing sector in the world, is educational publishing, mainly comprising kindergarten through 12th grade or secondary school, but also in many cases college textbooks and after-school educational material. So we represent those three sectors. We do not represent necessarily newspapers, but in all these three areas, of course, we also represent the digital side of publishing. It's not just paper, it's digital as well.
Now you are Secretary General of IPA, but I understand that your background is in law. What do you find particularly interesting about copyright law on an international scale?
Well, the first thing I find interesting about copyright law at an international scale is that actually copyright law is truly international. It is something where what's happening at an international level really impacts on how copyright develops nationally. Secondly, what's really fun about it is that it is at the intersection of two other important elements. And one is technology, because copyright influences technology and technology influences copyright, and public policy. Governments have to make decisions about their policies on how they want to provide educational content, how they want their cultural industries to contribute to their society and economy. And all these things interact, and one of the places where they interact is copyright law. So that's what makes it so truly international, truly strategic, and really quite fun.
Thank you. One challenge for copyright is that copyright is national in application, and countries often have their own copyright laws and procedures. There are, however, treaties that many countries have signed in order to create a common set of standards to protect intellectual property across national borders. What is currently, in your opinion, the most important legal framework for copyright protection in the international arena?
Well, funnily enough, I think the most important international treaty which governs and supports the way copyright works around the world is also the oldest treaty. It was created in 1886, and it is the so-called Berne Convention on copyright and related rights. It is a treaty in which countries were responding to the first wave of globalization, and Charles Dickens' works were suddenly being mass translated and mass reproduced on the other side of the Atlantic, and equally Mark Twain found his books being used and reproduced, and often without his permission, in many other countries. So that first international treaty, which is one of the oldest international treaties, full stop, really, is still the most important today because it lays down all the fundamental principles of copyright protection that we have today.
You've been with IPA for over 10 years and have first-hand experience in seeing changes in international publishing. Now, thinking back when you began in 2003, what have been major challenges and changes in terms of technology, publishing, and copyright?
Well, the thing that people don't realize is how much publishing has always been aware of and in touch with the latest technological developments. Publishers, as being part of the media, really know what's going on and see the changes going on around them. And the biggest challenge for the past 20 years has been trying to find the right space between being a visionary and being a Luddite. So not being too far ahead of the users and of the customers in the kind of technology you're trying to offer to them, and also not being too far behind so that once you've actually made created new digital products, your customers have moved further on. So the most interesting thing I've been watching in the last 10 years is this attempt of publishers to get it right. And mostly you see some barging ahead, trying a new technology, and then failing because the audience isn't there yet. But 1 or 2 or 3 years later, suddenly the audience is there, the customers are there, the market is there, and things happen. This was, of course, most obvious in the U.S., when the ebook finally took off. The Kindle wasn't the first device, and the iPad wasn't the second device to actually provide a good reading, a book reading experience. There had been at least a half a dozen technologies and platforms that tried and failed before that, simply because the technology just wasn't right there, or because the audience just wasn't yet comfortable with reading on a machine. So getting it right, getting that timing right, has always been the hardest challenge in adapting to the new ways that consumers want to read.
That's very interesting. In your time at IPA, you've also been involved with the World Intellectual Property Organization, or WIPO. Can you tell us more about WIPO's role in copyright and explain to our listeners how collective licensing, or the concept of collective licensing, works?
Sure. So let's first talk about WIPO. WIPO is a United Nations special agency, the same way as UNESCO is a special agency, or the International Telecommunications Union, or the Universal Postal Union are special United Nations agencies. And the WIPO, or WIPO, deals with one particular aspect, and that is intellectual property. And intellectual property deals with, on the one hand, the patents, trademarks, industrial design, even seeds. And on the other hand, it deals with copyright, so the rights of authors, performers, and other creators. So in all these areas, WIPO, first and foremost, is there to administer international treaties. And to date, WIPO has over 35 international treaties under its belt, each one signed by between 150 countries, in which these countries undertake to handle intellectual property and to respect the intellectual property of foreign rights holders in a specific way. So the first task that WIPO actually has is to administer these treaties. And I already mentioned earlier the Berne Convention, which is the oldest one. It has been updated in the late 90s to adapt to digital technology through a treaty called the World Copyright Treaty. And but there's a whole list of others, and they're all administered by this organization, and member states meet regularly to make sure that these treaties are up to date and to hold each other accountable for applying them properly. Now, that's the most important thing that WIPO does, and the one that is formally most visible. But what's also interesting is that WIPO thinks about the infrastructure that is needed to promote and protect intellectual property. So WIPO does a lot of work in the area of capacity building, in particular in developing countries. It helps set up patent offices. It helps ensure that there are skilled people on the ground who can register trademarks, design, and know how to and understand copyright, and can advise them on how to run their copyright regimes. And in that context, collective licensing plays a special role, and it's going to play a bigger role in the future. Countries need to develop their copyright and collective licensing infrastructure in order to meet the challenges of the digital environment.
Content is steadily becoming more accessible. Under the WIPO framework, an international treaty has been adopted to facilitate access to published content for blind, visually impaired, and otherwise print-disabled people. What does this treaty mean for consumers, content creators, and publishers? Do you see any broader relevance for copyright as such?
Yes, well, this treaty, the Marrakesh Treaty for the facilitation of access for persons with print disability, really has importance and value at very different levels. First of all, at its very literal sense, it's going to encourage countries to introduce national copyright exceptions for the benefit of print disabled people, i.e. blind and visually impaired people. Secondly, it's going to create and or allow the creation of a new infrastructure internationally where these special accessible files, which are often, you know, lots of investment is made to make these digital files more accessible, can be exchanged internationally. So that's what this treaty does at the literal level. What's more interesting and more important is that WIPO is going with the times and recognizing that intellectual property, on the one hand, of course, has to protect the investors and the rights holders and the authors and creators, but that sharing and access is the new paradigm, and they have to adjust the copyright regime to a world in which people want to be able to share more, and where ultimately, I don't even think rights holders mind that their works are being shared, but at the same time, there has to be ways of ensuring that the business models which sustain the creative industries there are business models there that can work. And this is where WIPO doesn't have a role of dictating, but enabling the infrastructure for these new kinds of business models. And that's the real fun and exciting part of WIPO's work.
Now you've talked about organizations like WIPO. What is IPA's relationship with WIPO? And why are these relationships important? What influence does IPA have here?
I wish I could say here now and honestly say we have enormous amount of influence, and there's a big ear at WIPO, which is constantly turned in our direction. WIPO is an organization filled with government experts, and sometimes these government experts are expert diplomats and not experts in creative industries or experts even in intellectual property. So one of the things, one of the reasons why IPA has an observer status with all United Nations agencies, and including WIPO, is because they simply need reality input. They need to know what's going on the ground so that they understand that what and how the measures that they are discussing here in Geneva impact authors and readers around the world. So we provide some reality for these organizations and help them understand what's happening out there. I think the second thing that we do is we try to collaborate with them in developing copyright industries in the developing world. So when someone asks, we're a small African country and we think we should have a creative industry and we just don't know how to do it, then we help explain to them how and what they can do to actually ensure that people will invest into publishing, people will pay authors and publish their books, and how you create the first steps to develop a infrastructure that supports a creative industry. So we advise them there and we help them with this capacity building work. And then there's this third area, which is looking forward. We all know that the world is changing. We know that copying as it used to be perceived when these old treaties were created in 1886, that it has changed. It's not a rare event. It is a thing every one of us does massively. And how do we now adapt, and how can we develop an infrastructure in the future that allows for business to continue and for a knowledge economy to be developed in the internet? And here again, WIPO is forward-looking and tries to help see, envisage what the infrastructure could look like, not telling people what they should be doing, but just understanding that there needs to be things in place, for example, to ensure that rights clearance and rights and permissions can be granted as fast as works can be pirated. And this is, by the way, one area where collective licensing will play a very, very important role.
IPA is also an associate member with the International Federation of Reproduction Rights Organization, or IFRO. To clarify for our listeners, what is IFRO's role in copyright in the publishing industry?
IFRO stands for International Federation of Reproduction Rights Organizations. And originally it was set up because it was a new technology and it was threatening the way publishing worked. And that new technology in the 1960s and 70s was the photocopier. And the IFRO and its member reproduction rights organizations were there to ensure that where there was photocopying at a massive scale of published works, the publishers and authors would receive some kind of compensation for the use of their work in these ways and for the loss of sales that they had incurred. Now, the photocopier, of course, is a technology that we still use and still is important, but it's not the only one. It is now morphed into a digital copying machine, which can do all kinds of things. And here again, publishers are faced with a situation where these uses, at least to a certain extent, are absolutely legitimate, and we want to encourage them and we don't want to stop them. But on the other hand, there is also the legitimate interest of the person and the rights holders whose works are being copied and whose efforts are being used by somebody else, that they get some form of compensation. So IFRO and its member organizations, including the Copyright Clearance Center in the U.S., are working very, very hard on finding proper models which create a fair compensation mechanism for authors and publishers without interfering too much with what the users want to do once they have a work in a digital form. There are, of course, others. Every country in the industrialized world has an RRO. So you have VG Wort in Germany, you have CFC in France. There are plenty of others, Copydan in Denmark, Copymor in Norway, Kopiosto in Finland, etc., etc., etc. It's a mechanism which is well developed and has always been slow to move into technologies, but ultimately finds its way and then helps grease the relationship between the rights holders and the users as the users find new ways they want to use works.
Let's talk about publishers and rights holders for a minute. Sometimes rights holders face challenges in public opinion? How can rights holders regain the moral high ground? How can we better communicate the value of publishing?
That is a good, great question. But allow me to rephrase it slightly. You say, how can we regain the moral high ground? I don't think this is a question of moral high ground. I think the big issue is how do we communicate the value of publishing? How do we explain to people what publishers bring to the table in the digital environment, and why, therefore, the work we do and the efforts we make and the investments we do actually merit respect and merit some financial compensation as well. So let me give you one example, and that is a hotly contested issue today in the area of educational publishing called OER, or Open Educational Resources. The premise of open educational resources is that nowadays, with all the teachers being online and everybody to be able to share everything, there really is no need for professional educational content developers, i.e. educational publishers. And wouldn't it be nice if just teachers naturally got together and, you know, all shared their wisdom and they collaborated, and this, through this collaboration, you would get a wonderful new school text resources, and we wouldn't have to buy books anymore, and we wouldn't have to buy content from publishers anymore. We could just crowdsource it for free and save a lot of costs. Everybody would have access, and education would magically flourish. Now, the reality is actually quite different, and I can give many examples from different countries, whether NDLR in Norway, or the One Laptop Per Child project in the Catalunya, or Wikiverse in the Netherlands. These are all examples where people have completely underestimated how hard it actually is to create good educational textbooks. And in each of these cases, and through different mechanisms, they have tried to replace publishers. And in each of these cases, they have completely failed. And that is because actually being an educational publisher is quite hard. It's not just about being a teacher. You actually have a lot of other skills you have to bring to the table. And the reason why we've had these terrible, misguided projects out there is because the publishing industry, the educational publishers, have not been able to explain, or the politicians have not understood what educational publishers actually do, and therefore why it is important not to push them aside, but actually to integrate them in these new products and these new political projects. So if you're going to have a new digital resource, how do you actually get the publishers, how do you incentivize them to put their products into it? That is really the question, rather than the question of how can we do away with them and replace them with a wiki. So our biggest challenge is how do we regain the moral high ground, really is communicating the value that publishers bring to the table. And here we have two problems, really. The first problem is the one, obviously, you know, we have to communicate what we do. We have to explain to people publishers aren't just printers. We actually do more. But the second problem is a little bit more complicated, because we actually have to be quite clear about it ourselves and in our own minds what it is that we can contribute and that we do contribute. And publishers are not very good at formulating that for themselves and therefore acting on it. Those publishers who still think that all they're doing is taking content, you know, proofreading it, and putting it on paper, or putting it, wrapping it into a digital envelope and putting it online, those are the publishers who are going to fail. The publishers that are now really successful and the ones that are building a future-proof business are the ones that recognize that the old added value is somewhat being eroded, and that we have to find the new added value, the ways that we can create and place our works and our things into the context in which they are now being consumed. So, just to give you a very obvious example, Pearson is no longer considers itself as the world's biggest educational publisher. It now calls itself the learning company, because they see that it's not just about putting pedagogical content onto paper and then putting that into the hands of teachers and students. It is also about thinking about the context in which these things are being used, and then thinking about how can we serve that context even better? How can we provide additional information to students who want to do extra work at home? How do we provide extra material for the teachers so that they don't have to prepare so hard? How can we provide services around this, around grading, around communication to teachers, around communication to students? There's plenty of things that can be done as a new added value based on the fact that these people provide great content which enables education. So, two problems. One is actually figuring out what the added value is, and secondly, then actually getting through to the policymakers and explaining it to them and showing that actually publishing is not a 19th century profession. It is something that, while changing, is more needed than ever in the 21st century.
Now, as someone with inside knowledge of copyright and the publishing world, can you discuss with us any other important developments our listeners should be aware of? What is your take on the most important trends in copyright globally, and what are they?
The biggest trend in educational publishing I already mentioned was this misunderstanding that people think they can solve through open educational resources. The other area that is really a fundamental problem is that people think copyright is too hard, and therefore the only way to solve access issues and copyright issues is through copyright exceptions. And that is purely and simply misguided, because copyright exceptions are extremely blunt instruments. They are extremely non-tech. They are extremely unsophisticated, and ultimately they damage the business model. The more clever ways of resolving the same issue, i.e. the issue of how do we promote access, would require a collaboration, would require the clever use of the new technologies that we have, and would require a little bit more effort in getting together and seeing how we can actually create win-win situations. And I'd like to get back to this Treaty for the Blind, which is just a great example for copyright exceptions on the one hand, and the possible solutions, other solutions and alternative and complementary solutions on the other hand. If you think of a blind person wanting to read a book, the most expensive way to make that book available for him is for an organization to buy a copy of that book, rip off the spine off its back, digitize it, scan it, proofread it, convert it into the, you know, the special formats, and then make it available to persons with print disability. It is much more clever to get a publisher, in particular someone who's producing a digital book, to either provide a digital file directly to a conversion house, which enhances it and makes it turns it into a special accessible copy for visually impaired, or actually to even get the publishers to make the commercial versions accessible from the outset. So that, however, requires collaboration. It requires the understanding of what the technological issues are and finding ways of solving that. And I'm really pleased that the World Blind Union and the International Publishers Association are part of a team that is organized here by WIPO to solve this issue, to actually say, look, what are the actual obstacles that prevent a person with a print disability from reading? And why don't we address those rather than use this clunky system of a copyright exception and then the old analog to digital conversion that the copyright exception that the treaty allows. So this misunderstanding that copyright is an area where we need to have trench warfare, where we need big, you know, legal bazookas which blast holes in other people's rights, that is the only solution. That's the problem. The better way forward is to sit together and say, look, what is it that you need? How can we help and provide it for you? And how can at the same time you take into account and respect our concerns and interests? And again, for the visually impaired, it's a wonderful example. The best book for a person with print disability is the book that he can have access to at the same time, at the same price, through the channels of his choice or the same channels that anybody else uses. So working towards equality is a much more constructive, a much more fairer way of solving this issue than battling about copyright exceptions.
We've already talked briefly about challenges faced by publishers and how challenges evolved in publishing. What other challenges, in your opinion, are publishers and rights holders facing today?
That's a big question. And I think I've answered it in the many questions we've talked it through so far. I think the biggest issue for publishers is to understand the technology that their users are using and to provide their content in exactly the way that their users want it. That means often embracing new technologies, but it also means that we shouldn't forget that actually books are a great thing. And unlike music and film, where the actual physical object which carries the information holds no value, books are slightly different. A lot of people in a lot of contexts want to have a physical book. They enjoy reading it. Paper books are scientifically proven to be more effective and when you're reading it for learning as well. There's lots of reasons why we shouldn't just run off into the digital world, but we should recognize that paper can be a great medium as well. And straddling those two worlds, the digital and the paper one, that's a particular challenge which the publishing industry faces more than music, more than film.
Thank you, Jens. We've been chatting today with the Secretary General of IPA, Jens Bammel. Thank you again for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure, Mitya. Thank you. If I may add just one more thing, if you're interested in these topics and you're interested in following the International Publishers Association, please follow me on my Twitter handle, which is IPA Secretary, or on LinkedIn, where you'll find me under Jens Bammel. Thank you very much.
Copyright on the Continent is produced by Rights Direct, the international subsidiary of Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker making copyright compliance easy for more than 35,000 organizations around the globe. You can follow us on Twitter under @RightsDirect, find us on Facebook or LinkedIn, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes. Visit our website, www.rightsdirect.com, for educational videos, white paper, resources about copyright. Our podcast series is also available through Beyond the Book, the popular podcast from Copyright Clearance Center on the business of writing and publishing. My name is Mitya Linz. For all of us at Rights Direct, thanks for listening to our latest edition of Copyright on the Continent.